candidate in the provincial election.
With a media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarising images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening and thanks for joining us on National Aboriginal Day. Today on the show, we bring you another edition of Groundwire, grassroots news from campus and community radio stations across the nation. This edition of Groundwire focuses on the upcoming G20 in Toronto, where independent community and campus stations from across the country are reporting on the ground and at the Alternative Media Centre. Also on the show, we bring you an interview with Vancouver activists caravanning with other activists to the G20 in Toronto. But before all that, we will bring you our weekly feature with Colleen Kimmett from the TIE. In this ongoing collaboration, Colleen joins us over the phone to chat about some recent stories published on the TIE.ca, the independent daily online news magazine. Today, we'll look at a 6-million-year-old salmon, Canadian journalists chewing away at their muzzles, and what a rat looks like to provincial conservatives. All this and more right here on News 101, your source for independent news. But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Neil Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Kyrgyz troops stormed an Uzbek town today. Witnesses say soldiers beat villagers, killing two people and injuring dozens. Kyrgyz officials acknowledged the operation, but did not comment on the claims of violence. During the past week, as many as 2,000 people died as a result of ethnic violence in the region, and nearly half of the 800,000-strong Uzbek population has fled. Many are afraid to return to their homes, afraid of the very Kyrgyz troops who are trying to convince them that it's safe. Ethnic Uzbeks say that last week's violence was supported by Kyrgyz forces. Most of those displaced remain along the border, where they are still in need of food and potable water. Relief supplies finally began to reach them yesterday. A radical Islamic militia in Somalia issued an order today that all men in the country's capital, Mogadishu, must grow their beards, warning that those that don't will be punished. The same group, Hizbul Islam, is on the verge of joining forces with the Somali government. Abdul Karim Jamali reports.
Somali Prime Minister Abdurrahman Haji Aden announced Sunday that the government is negotiating with Hizbul Islam extremists. Aden said that the group will join the government troops soon before the country's Independence Day on the 1st of July. He added that the militia has no ties to Al-Qaeda. The militants are led by Sheikh Hassan Dahir Awais, who has been on the U.S. list of people linked to terrorism since the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Hizbul Islam is the second most powerful rebel militia in Somalia. They will join Ahlus Sunnah, a moderate Islamist movement that signed a similar agreement earlier this year, to join forces with the government to fight against Al-Shabaab extremists. Somalia has been without a functioning government for the last two decades. Nearly 21,000 Somalis have been killed in the past 3 years, after clashes between radical Islamists and the government troops broke out on January 2007. Abdul Karim Jimale, FSRN.
The U.S. in Kabul announced on Friday that it has decided who will protect U.S. consulates in two Afghan cities. The contract went to an offshoot of Z Services, formerly known as Blackwater Enterprises. The deal is worth $120 million for 1 year and can be extended for a total length of a year and a half. At least 46 miners died in China today. They were killed by carbon dioxide fumes after an explosion in the shaft. China has the world's most dangerous mining record. More than 2,600 workers were killed in Chinese mines last year. In West Virginia today, inspectors returned to the Upper Big Branch mine. They'll make sure it's safe before investigators go back in to try to figure out what caused an explosion there in early April that killed 20 miners. Last week, they discovered two small coal fires in the mine. Low-income and minority students in New York gathered yesterday to celebrate a victory in their struggle to save their free or reduced Metro fare cards after more than 1,000 students staged a school walkout over the issue last week. Jaisal Noor has more.
The New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority has dropped its plan to scrap subsidized Metro cards for over 500,000 youth from low-income families in New York City. In a bill passed Friday, the state agreed to contribute a portion of the costs, as did the city, but the program will still cost the MTA some $144 million. This cost could sink the agency further into debt. As a result, the MTA may still have to raise fares more than 7.5% in the next year if ridership does not increase. Student groups representing low-income, immigrant, and minority communities worked together to defeat the proposal. They organized an intense lobbying campaign, held press conferences, and spoke out at rallies.
Students united will never be defeated! The students united.
Valerie Beinhart is a member of the Urban Youth Collaborative.
So figure out a long-term plan because it can't be a fight every single year. It's just like putting a temporary bandage over an open wound.
Organizers say they will continue their campaign until the one-year extension is made permanent. Jaisal Noor, FSRN, New York.
Protests continued in Egypt over the weekend. Demonstrators were beaten and dozens of them arrested while calling for an end to police brutality. The demonstrations began 10 days ago after a young man, Khalid Said, refused to be searched and was hauled off by police in Alexandria. Shortly thereafter, he was found brutally beaten and dead. Protesters are calling for an end to police brutality they say is all too common. Officials deny that Egyptian police routinely overstep their bounds. An investigation into Said's death is ongoing. NBA giant Manute Bol died over the weekend. Bol spent 10 years playing on various teams, never forgetting his native Sudan. Bol founded the group Sudan Sunrise and worked to end oppression in his homeland. He supported opposition political movements and worked for peace in the impoverished African nation. Manute Bol was just 47 years old. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. We now turn to Andrew Longhurst and Colleen Kimmett for the weekly feature to discuss the most recent stories in the Tyee.
Thank you, Bronwyn. As Bronwyn mentioned, the Tyee's Colleen Kimmett joins us over the phone to talk about some of the most recently published articles from the Independent Online magazine. Thanks for joining us, Colleen.
Hi, glad to be here.
So lawyers with the BC Public Interest Advocacy Center are criticizing the Housing and Social Development Ministry's attempt to take welfare recipients to court to collect money for overpayments, and they're asking the ministry to give them what they need to help people. Can you tell us a little bit more about this story?
Sure. It was in late May that Minister Coleman announced that the ministry had filed 317 cases in small claims court seeking repayments. He said some of the cases involved fraud, welfare fraud, while others simply may have filed incorrect information that resulted in overpayments at the time. Now, lawyers with the British Columbia Public Interest Advocacy Center are criticizing the ministry's attempt to take welfare recipients to court. They say that the government's overpayment cases often fall apart under legal scrutiny and that the people they are attacking are not well prepared to defend themselves. Taking these claims to court in a climate where legal aid has been cut back for people living in poverty, And in this case, the ministry didn't even bother to contact groups like the BC Public Interest Advocacy Center that work for welfare recipients. And so the advocacy center said they were not prepared for the influx of people coming to them saying, you know, what's going on? I need help. And one lawyer with the center said that, you know, looking at these types of overpayment cases over the years, the center has actually succeeded in having well over $1 million in alleged overpayments canceled.
And so at this point, where is the BCPIAC, BC Public Interest Advocacy Center, going to push further?
Well, right now it's trying to develop a strategy and a coordinated effort to deal with all of the claims they've seen. And basically they're doing the best they can, although in the article, Minister Coleman didn't respond to requests for comment, so it's not clear what the ministry thinks of what the Advocacy Center is saying or whether they're going to address any of its concerns.
Okay. And can we look forward to more coverage from Andrew McLeod on this?
Yeah, Andrew is our legislative bureau reporter in Victoria, and he's going to be on this as it unfolds.
Great. And in an opinion piece written by Mitchell Anderson, he says that Vancouver, so I'm moving to another article, he says that Vancouver has quietly become a major outflow of what Greenpeace calls the world's dirtiest oil. What are the forces at play making Vancouver such a major oil port?
Well, the forces, it seems, are China. China is a major force. I mean, the driver so far with this expansion in the pumping oil through the Port of Vancouver has been the oil sands, which saw production climb to 2.72 million barrels of synthetic crude last year. Now, the majority of the oil and the bitumen coming from the oil sands is transported by pipeline to U.S. refineries currently, where it supplies 8% of domestic demand. But companies that have invested in the oil sands remain vulnerable to an almost complete reliance on American markets. And in the U.S., growing concern about climate change and the election of Barack Obama may become a cost to producers. So increasingly, oil sands investors are looking to China, and China is looking to the oil sands. This year, the Conservative government approved the sale of $1.9 billion in oil sands assets to two companies controlled by the Chinese government. And there's another $4.65 billion deal that will increase Beijing's investment in the oil sands to $7 billion.
So clearly, China has a huge stake in this.
Exactly, and they want to expand pipeline capacity through BC to the coast, where oil will be exported to China. Mm-hmm. And I've talked before on the show about the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline, which is being proposed to transport oil from Alberta to the Kitimat port. But that's made a lot of attention. Local First Nations are vehemently opposed to it. It's likely going to be a long battle for regulatory approval. And the Burrard Inlet is currently the only sands access to the Pacific Ocean and to Chinese markets.
Hmm. Interesting. So I want to move to another opinion piece. This one is from Shannon Rupp. She commends Vancouver School Board Chair Patty Baucus for standing up for what she sees as the public interest in a time when so many politicians are doing exactly the opposite. What are the main points that she touches upon in this opinion piece?
Well, yeah, I mean, she talks about this, what she sees as a new and exciting trend of politicians sticking up for the public interest. I wanted to talk about this piece because it really got a lot of reaction from our readers. So, I mean, first she talks about sort of the verbal sparring between Education Minister Margaret McDermott and Vancouver School Board Chair Patty Backus. And this is really about funding. Minister McDermott says there's no available funding for the Vancouver School Board District, and to any district for that matter, for the 2010-2011 school year. And Backus is saying, well, you know, the public is saying, we want funding. I mean, fund education. And the minister refuses to talk about it at all. And then Rep argues that, she first spotted this trend last year when the NDP's Spencer Chandra Herbert for Vancouver West End challenged the Campbell government on its fiscally irresponsible cuts to the arts. Now, she called this a ballsy move because the NDP has not traditionally been a champion of arts and culture funding, which some of our online commenters disagreed with, but, you know, that's why it's an opinion piece. And she also touched on Blair Lextrom, who opted to represent his constituents in the Peace River and oppose the HST instead of towing the Liberal line.
Great. So a lot of different issues at play in this one article, just which was sort of framed around Patty Backus and the ongoing dispute between the province, the Ministry of Education, and the Vancouver School Board. Well, thank you so much, Colleen, for joining us again this week. We always appreciate it, and we look forward to next week.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Take care now.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Colleen Kimmett from the Tyee.ca. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for an interview with an activist headed with other Vancouver activists to the G20 in Toronto. That's right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Bronwyn Loden. You're either hearing us live, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at 101.9 on the FM dial, or streaming online at CITR. You can also find our podcasts on our website, citr.ca. The G20 summit in Toronto is only days away, and activists and organisers are preparing for one of Canada's largest convergences as protesters descend on Toronto from across the country. Yesterday, the Vancouver People's Summit brought together activists, members of civil society, academics and community members to address women's rights initiatives and climate change. The purpose of the Vancouver People's Summit was to send a strong message to politicians that Canadians care about these two issues. Following the summit, a caravan left at 8 p.m. from Main Street en route to Toronto, picking up others along the way. CITR News Director Andrew Longhurst spoke with a Vancouver activist on his way to Toronto for the G20 summit. Eason, who asked that his last name not be used, is travelling with other activists to protest the upcoming G20 summit. Andrew spoke with Eason just as the caravan was leaving Calgary.
Can you tell me a bit about who you're with and why you're headed to Toronto?
So I'm with a bunch of people, several of which who I previously knew, and we came from Vancouver, and we just picked up a group of people in Calgary, and we're moving on to Winnipeg to pick up one more person, and then we're going to go to the G20 summit in Toronto.
And were you at the Vancouver People Summit yesterday?
Yeah, I was briefly.
Okay, and can you briefly tell me a little bit about that for our listeners as well?
Okay, so I guess the People Summit was kind of like gathering at the end of Main Street. I think most of the organizations there were liberal organizations calling for kind of like a reform of global economic systems to better support oppressed peoples of the world. So you had groups like Oxfam and Greenpeace there. I wasn't there for that long, but those were kind of most of the groups that I saw.
The idea with the People Summit was to obviously send a message to leaders, but also send people to the G20 in Toronto as a caravan. Is that's right?
Yeah.
And so you're caravanning with a number of people. Are people coming from different organizations? Give me a little background about who's all there.
I mean, out of the people who I know, I think we're kind of more of the militant anarchist breed, and we're going to the summit for just informed by a general critique of neoliberal capitalism, which extends to many issues. Some of the most relevant ones among people that I'm going with include national housing, economic destruction, ecological destruction, such as tankers and oil pipelines, and especially the tar sands, but also just like a general critique of economic control exercised by the top economies, which will be at the G20 summit.
And now, is there a particular group that you're associated with?
I work with two groups. One is the Vancouver chapter of Food Not Bombs, and the other is a relatively newly formed group called Vancouver Action, or VanAct for short.
Okay. And are you meeting up with members of other Toronto groups as well once you arrive in Toronto?
Yeah, I think the general umbrella network we're meeting up with is the TCMN, which is the Toronto Community Mobilization Network. Basically, a general framework for Toronto radicals opposed to the G20 summit to work under.
Okay. And so actually just recently, the Integrated Security Unit announced that they will add water cannons to their arsenal, so to speak. How does, and there's also sound cannons as well, sound devices to disperse crowds. It seems like they're expecting quite a bit in terms of resistance. How do you feel about the build-up, the security build-up, and the present security presence in Toronto?
Well, as I kind of see it, since the Seattle WTO protests, when police forces were defeated in the streets, there's always been an ever-growing concern that that can't be repeated. So the police will generally try to ramp up their efforts and deploy vastly disproportionate force in response to protests. So regardless of the nature of protests, whether they're confrontational or militant or peaceful, the police need to have some sort of peace of mind that they're going to be able to exercise control over any potential situation which may arise. And so with water cannons and sound cannons, I think one of the elements with that is that they're trying to introduce new novel forms of crowd control that perhaps aren't as vilified or don't have as much baggage as tasers or tear gas or rubber bullets may have.
Okay. And are you willing to get arrested during the G20?
I do not plan to get arrested. However, that being said, I cannot control the actions of the police.
Can you give me a sense of the types of forms of civil disobedience that you plan to involve yourself in?
There's two events that are occurring. One is a general walkout in Tent City, which I plan on being at. Another event is called Get Off the Fence, which is basically a call out to leftists of various breeds to kind of, you know, get off of the metaphorical fence and decide where they want to sit in the struggle, whether they're going to, I guess it's specifically directed towards more middle-class varieties, whether they're going to continue benefiting off of the systems of privilege which they currently do, or if they're going to begin attacking those systems of privilege to dismantle them.
Hmm. And is there any word from, have you been in contact with organizers in Toronto about the state of this security there, and are there reports of intimidation? And I know previously some of the organizers from various groups were receiving visits from the ISU and other security forces. Are there still reports coming out similar to that?
Yeah, very similar reports. And also, additionally, the police have stopped and, in several cases, arrested and detained several activists, organizers overnight over quite trivial incidences. So there was a lot of the same of what happened in Vancouver preceding the Vancouver Olympic Games, and so all the same stuff is happening in Toronto, plus a little extra.
Okay.
That was CITR News Director Andrew Longhurst in conversation with a Vancouver activist en route to Toronto for the G20. We now turn to Groundwire, grassroots news from campus and community radio stations across the country. This edition of Groundwire focuses on the upcoming G20 summit in Toronto.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News. I'm Max Scott.
And I am Susie Alvarez.
From CKLN and the G20 Alternative Media Center, we bring you Groundwire Goes to the G20, the first of two editions with features on global issues from the G20 summit.
In this edition,
the state has very little control over who ends up getting injured.
We want Canada to recommend abroad that all these countries that have signed the rights of women live up to what they have signed.
And the economic realm is one of the most important parts of our lives, and we need to reclaim it.
But first, the national headlines. For a small group of Christian Aboriginal leaders, the time has come to publicly forgive the Canadian government for the abuse suffered by First Nations, Inuit, and Métis children in church-run residential schools. Kenny Blacksmith, the founder of Gathering Nations International and former chief of the Cree community of Mitissini in northern Quebec, says, quote, "We've experienced the power of forgiveness, and we want forgiveness as a way of life from here on," end quote.
Though the federal apology was issued 2 years ago, the group now wants to honor Harper with a ceremonial chief's headdress, which many First Nations people have claimed is an insult. Gunnarji O'Sullivan.
I'm a First Nations woman. I was in the residential school. My mother went to the residential school. And to this day, I still see people who are losing their children. Young youth who are giving birth are losing their children to the system. So I personally do not forgive. I do not forgive because our healing fund was cut in half after the apology. And plus, I found that the residential school agreement was trickery upon my people. I do not forgive Stephen Harper, and I will never forgive. I just can't. I'm sorry.
Also this week, federal legislation that previously allowed First Nations children to be removed from their homes to residential schools has been officially removed.
Canadians are now permitted to watch Al Jazeera English, a 24-hour global news service in Canada, carried by three major broadcast distributors. However, without specifically ordering Al Jazeera, Canadians will not see the channel, except with Quebec's Vidéotron. A year ago, openmedia.ca launched a campaign urging Canadians to contact the CRTC in support of Al Jazeera English. Of the approximately 2,800 public comments submitted to the CRTC, all were in favor of Al Jazeera, except 40 parties who filed comments in opposition to bringing the broadcaster to Canada. The three major distributors now offering Al Jazeera English are Bell TV Rogers and Vidéotron. In the West, Shaw is not carrying it as of now, and TELUS and Al Jazeera are still in negotiations. Noted author A.V. Lewis spoke recently with Steve Anderson about what Al Jazeera's inclusion means for Canadian viewers.
Al Jazeera's method is to hire people from the countries where they're going to be reporting from. And for the broadcast, the majority of the broadcast centers to be based in the Global South, for the majority of the news bureaus to be based in the Global South, and for the Global South to have a global platform from which to tell its own stories. We don't get it right every day. There are lots of times when I'm watching Al Jazeera when, you know, I groan because I see something that I feel is kind of a news cliche or the way that things are always done. But a number of times every day, I watch the channel that I work for with tremendous pride. And I think as more Canadians get a look at what we do, I think that it'll spark a lot of really interesting conversations in Canada.
Also this week, Ottawa stands up for the Algonquin right to retain their traditional government. 30 Algonquins of Barrier Lake plus dozens of supporters gathered in Ottawa for 2 days of campaigning against the Conservative government's imposition of Indian Act Section 74. Barrier Lake is one of roughly 25 communities across the country left with their customary governance system.
Section 74 will mean replacing their traditional governance system with elections and a banned council. Section 74 hasn't been imposed forcibly on a community since 1924. The Haudenosaunee Confederacy was padlocked shut and traditional chiefs were put in jail and replaced by a banned council. Critics of Section 74 are calling the legislation unconstitutional and in contravention of international law. Community members see it as an act of assimilation and an attempt to sever their connection with their traditional territory.
Back home, the Conservative government, Harper, is trying to demolish our customs, trying to assimilate our community, and we are saying no to the Indian Act. No, we don't need that back home. Our customs has never been the problem. Indian Act is the problem.
Divided for many years, the Algonquin communities are now reconciling and have united against the imposition of Section 74. The violence that erupted in Tivoli Gardens, Jamaica, captured worldwide attention. Jamaican Canadians are responding to organized crime in the garrison communities where the recent clashes have taken place.
Between May 24th and May 27th, clashes between the state's armed forces and civilians in the Jamaican capital of Kingston left 73 dead, a number many fear could be significantly higher. The violence predominantly occurred in the Kingston neighborhoods of Denham Town and Tivoli Gardens. Civilians in these neighborhoods took up arms to defend gang leader Christopher Dudas Koch, whose extradition was requested by the United States in August 2009 on weapons and drugs charges. The Jamaican government stalled the search for Koch until last month. The Jamaican Canadian community has been upset by misconceptions about the geographical reach of the violence caused by mainstream media's reporting on the issue. Janice Dale, a Jamaican-Canadian journalist and radio host based in Montreal, expands on the limited geographical scope of the violence.
No different than anywhere in the world. Jamaica has different echelons of society. There are inner city areas where there are poverty and lack of education and lack of many other things. Those places often breed organized crime.
The violent clashes have called into question the historic connections between the two major political parties and organized crime, as well as how the high demand for drugs in Canada, the United States, and Europe is exacerbating the levels of violence seen in Jamaica.
You
can't go in the world without opposition to your plans. I'm making it twirl around your greedy fingers. We watching it swirl down the drain. Insane economics are false. See, we're not buying what you're selling, even with your propaganda. Tell the media barons rebelling. We're yelling, no
justice, no peace. Now, GroundWire goes to the G20.
The elite police see a better world we see. So we're free when we speak. Oil's at its peak, and we got at a beat. The status quo will keep us unable to speak. On our knees, saying, please, we reap what we sow. So you know the
hope. Welcome back to GroundWire Community Radio News.
In G20 News, the Toronto Police Union has called for Sid Ryan to resign. The president of the Ontario Federation of Labour had called on the police to assure the public they would not place agent provocateurs at the G20 protests, as had been done in Montebello, Quebec.
University of Toronto students and staff are being forced off their campus. Residents of dorms are being asked to relocate because the G20 security zone encompasses their buildings. Yet the students are only being refunded $100 for their trouble. And most puzzling, the new location is even closer to the G20. About 17 students and labor groups and 70 professors have condemned the closure and asked the university to reverse the decision. However, the administration has proceeded with the closure. Joita Gupta, VP of the Association of Part-Time Graduate Students. The G20 is more than sound cannons, fake lakes, and limousines. The G20 has also served as a focal point for community-based social justice movements to come together and imagine just economic alternatives. One such opportunity for dialogue was the Toronto versus the G20 teach-in, Candace Moore's report.
On Saturday, June 5th, 250 people gathered in the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education auditorium for a teach-in on the G20. The event was titled Toronto versus the G20. The first panel brought together anti-poverty activists, union organizers, and workers to talk about economic justice in Ontario.
The first is that the G20 is not coming here at the end of June. The G20 is already here, and it has been here for a long time. The second is that capitalism is an unjust system, and the only way to achieve justice is to overthrow it. And the third is that this is a part of a long-standing and ongoing struggle. There are a lot of new people that have been mobilized through this G20 organizing, and that is necessary, and it is exciting. And I implore everyone to see themselves within that history and to look to the future and to look to how to continue organizing in your communities and continue building a strong fight back.
AJ Withers is a member of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Rekha Sharma is a member of Unite Here Local 75. Her union represents over 7,000 workers in the hospitality industries.
June 24th is actually our first action at the Novotel Toronto Centre, where workers are planning rallies, pickets, work stoppages, and are going to be marching out of their workplace when the French delegates are staying at the Novotel Toronto Centre during the G20 to bring light to these issues.
On June 3rd, Unite Here Local 75 announced that the union voted 94% in favour of a strike authorization vote. The vote sent a clear message to employers that workers are willing to go on strike if their bargaining demands are not met. Their demands include workplace safety, stable jobs, and health and welfare. Many of the employers are hotels owned by French-based company Accor.
We're actually just planning to focus right now on Accor. Accor has been having organizing drives in Morocco and Indonesia, and the French unions as well as the Brazilian unions have also decided to target Accor as a negative employer that does not respect workers' rights. The reason why Accor is set as a target is because in 1995, Accor actually signed an agreement with the International Union of Food Service Workers, saying that they will not oppose efforts for unionization in their workplaces around the world. Yet, there's only two unionized hotels in North America. There is something wrong with that picture.
Ajamu Nangwaya is a student and member of QP Ontario. He believes that workers represent the backbone of economic production.
I think we have to start to think about building the road as we travel. And the economic realm is one of the most important parts of our lives. And we need to reclaim it from the capitalists. We need to reclaim it from the state. But it's going to be a battle of will. And there are resources that exist in the state that we, through contestation, we can force them to finance the very system that's going to lead to their destruction, but it's going to lead means political mobilization, political education, and the willingness to work for long-term structural change in the context of this system.
For Groundwire, I'm Candace Moores, reporting from CHRY-FM in Toronto.
Thanks to Annabelle Koo and Candace Moores, CHRY 105.5 FM Toronto, for that report. And now.
There has been much play in the mainstream media over the last few weeks about the long-range acoustic device, or LRAD, that the police will be using against protesters during the G20 protests. However, activists around the world who have experienced this sound weapon argue against its effectiveness.
CKUT Radio's Aaron Lakoff has more.
In late May, the Toronto Police announced a new weapon which they'll be using to aid in crowd control during the G20 summit. The long-range acoustic device, or LRAD, has been dubbed a sound cannon by many. It is a high-quality speaker, generally mounted on top of a police vehicle, which can emit an extremely loud and high-pitched tone, which is far beyond the pain threshold for many. While the Toronto Police have insisted that they will only use the LRAD in short bursts, many activists are worried about the device causing long-term hearing damage. However, the LRAD may not be as effective a tool for crowd dispersal as the police would want the public to believe. It was also used against demonstrators during the G20 meetings in Pittsburgh in September of 2009. Groundwire spoke with Alex Bradley, who was a member of the Pittsburgh G20 Resistance Project. He directly experienced the LRAD on the streets of Pittsburgh last year.
For lots of other reasons, it's just not very tactically effective. You can neutralize it with cheap earplugs, it's line of sight, so it's strongest against one particular area. If they use the highest settings, you've got really, really serious risks of injuries to people. And I think the important point of that is the state has very little control over who ends up getting injured. And just from a legal standpoint and kind of from a risk aversion standpoint, that's not really in the state's interest.
While the LRAD is primarily a communication device, it also has what's known as a deterrent tone capability, which emits the high-pitched scream. Bradley describes how one can easily protect oneself from this function.
There was a couple times I was at the very front of the march, so about as close as people ended up getting to the LRAD when it was being used, and simply putting your fingers over your ears was enough to stay in the area.
Groundwire also spoke with Robert Putnam, who is in charge of investor and media relations for the LRAD company, who manufacture and distribute the devices out of San Diego. Putnam was questioned on other activists' claims that the LRAD can be easily neutralized if you cover your ears or wear earplugs.
It's absolutely true, and that's the whole point, but they can't say they can't hear it. They still can hear the instructions, they can still hear the deterrent tone, but you're right, it doesn't hurt them. And so that's why we believe that this is not a weapon, lethal or non-lethal or anywise, it's a communications tool, it's a communications device. And people can quickly neutralize it by wearing hearing protection.
Last week, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association filed an injunction against the Toronto Police and Ontario Provincial Police in order to stop the LRAD before it is used. In the meantime, the Council of Canadians has announced that they will hand out thousands of earplugs to protesters at the G20 in Toronto. For Groundwire, this is CKUT's Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal.
Justice for our communities. No to the G8 G20. Wondering why they can spend $1.1 billion on this photo shoot while closing your daycare and charging you to use the local pool?
Join us.
Help us tell them this isn't their city.
For more info, visit 25june.wordpress.com.
For details on other protests scheduled throughout the week of June 21st, check out attacktheroots.net. Tune in to CKLN 88.1 FM between June 25 and 27 for G20-focused coverage and reports.
We are making revolutionary radio.
The G20 leaders, largely comprised of males, have women on their radar at the upcoming summit. But does Canada really have any business leading the charge to improve the lives of women? Across Canada, feminists are meeting to create their own visions for the advancement of women. Last week in Toronto, this magazine hosted a lively roundtable discussion with Judy Rebick. And on the West Coast, reporter Alegira Imperial attended discussions led by elders and grandmothers. Groundwire examines what the G20 women's agenda would look like if women in Canada had a hand in shaping it.
women's voices at the table. Around 300 women and some men from various organizations gathered at the said celebration workshop, which followed a rally, discussed issues related to women's rights and gender equality, culminating in recommendations and actions that women want heeded by Canadian leaders and their counterparts at the meeting. Here today to talk about them are Elsie Dean, Alice West, Marianne Smith, and myself, Alegria Imperial, all members of Women Elders in Action. But first, why should women's voices get to the table? Elsie?
Perhaps I should say a little bit about the G8 and G20. Heads of governments of the richest 8 countries in the world and the richest 20 countries in the world, they get together and start to talk about how the world should be run, basically. And the objection that we feel is that we don't have any say. The ordinary people don't have any say because they meet behind closed doors. They do everything in secret. We don't know what their plan. They will not allow any observers, or very few, and they usually choose them. They decide whether there will be money for child care, for health, for pensions, care of seniors. All of these things are affected after these particular gatherings of the G8 and the G20. Discussion should be open, where you can listen to them and understand what is being done. It is our world, it is our resources, and we should know. So the women have, at least we're going to send resolutions to them. We'll send it to our government, and somehow we're going to have to check up and make sure that they raise these issues. With that, Alice, you were going to talk about some of the resolutions and discussion on a few of the issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think we have to look at what the state of women in the world is today. And one obvious, very blatant fact comes straightforward to us is the fact that so many women live in poverty. Actually, 70% of the world's poor are women. And that includes Canada, because we do have a poverty issue here in Canada as well. British Columbia in particular, for 6 years in a row, has had the highest child poverty rate in Canada. So we're not immune to all this. And there has to be some means of alleviating all this poverty and improving the incomes of women, because it is the women who are usually left with children when a family breaks up. They need this desperately. And the recommendation was that Canada should adopt a guaranteed livable income, and that makes sure that no individual spends more than 50% of his or her income on housing, food, and clothing, and childcare. And childcare is a very important issue in this. And it was also recommended that the government implement a national housing strategy that guarantees safe, affordable, sustainable housing for all. Now, this seems almost like an impossible dream, because it's been something that women have been fighting for years. We have to concentrate on, and we have to be sure that our governments are aware of what's happening to the ordinary person.
Well, this is Marion. I sat at the table for discussing violence against women, and we discussed the issues that affect mostly Canadian women. Certainly we are aware of the violence against women in other countries, but we weren't really able to discuss that because we are all women from this country. One of the things that came out of that, and one of the recommendations that we would have made, was that men begin to take some responsibility for violence against women. And to that end, we suggested an action of working on changing societal attitudes to violence against women, and address the portrayal of women in the media, and create new role models for men and women. And I sat at the housing table as well. Of course, I think that one of the issues for women being safe from violence is their housing. Our recommendations to the G8 and the G20 was to take their responsibility to provide adequate housing for each of the citizens in each of their countries, and in our country in particular, to have a national National Housing Plan, which we lost in the 90s. There was a time when the federal government had a housing plan and housing support.
I was at the climate change and food security table. I chose it because I'm very much aware of the changes going on in food production and food distribution and marketing. And it seems to be going far, far beyond what has been natural. If farming is being taken away by huge corporations, and slowly it's been creeping into the scenario as well, where will all that wisdom go about, you know, planting and seeding and harvesting? One of the recommendations that we came up with was that the federal government should contribute its fair share and support adaptation funding, which is to fund people dealing with the effects of climate change and food security. And the government should also support civil society organizations that have a gender and equality perspective and are dealing with food security as related to climate change. That we should also encourage governments to create legislation that opposes foreign ownership of land and regulates land use. We should also encourage the Canadian government in particular to take a leadership role on this issue. The other table that I was in was healthcare. And again, like all the other issues, if seen from a broad point of view, healthcare is what we're dealing with right now. It's merely, you know, the lack of right policies for healthcare, and that more and more corporations and private health insurance companies are coming in, and that public health care is being taken away.
I attended the table that was discussing peace, women, and militarism. We discussed what was the monetary cost and the resource cost that we give up in order to engage in war. World Watch is now saying that we are spending in this world $2.5 trillion each year to wage war and to provide the means for waging war. So they recommended that we demand that all military ads and promotions refrain from using women and children receiving help protection as the rationale for militarism and war. Because so many women have been told, and some believe, that we have gone into Afghanistan to help the women. We also said that we would lobby MPs and MLAs to abolish military recruitment in schools and universities. One of the tables, of course, was women in solidarity. And that means women around the world working together. So we want Canada to recommend abroad that all these countries that have signed the rights of women live up to what they have signed.
This is Alegria Imperial of We Act reporting for CJSF.
And now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. This year's National Community Radio Conference was an adventure to Gabriola Island in British Columbia. It was a different kind of conference that galloped at a comfortable pace thanks to the friendly island hosts. Unusually, this year's conference was also held at a station still building itself, CKGI.
This year, the National Community Radio Conference was held on the shores just off of Vancouver, BC, on the very beautiful, remote Gabriela Island.
So how are you feeling about the conference overall, Ken?
Well, overall, the conference went well. We had three objectives in fulfilling the conference. One was that people were coming here and they could learn something, so we had to provide an environment where the sessions could be held, and everybody seemed to be responding well to that. And the other one was that people had a good time, and actually on the meet and greet, the keg broke open and was leaking beer. We were handing out pitchers, so I think a good time was had. And the third pillar for the conference was that business was undertaken. I mean, the national organization needs to undertake national business. Plenary is held at the national conference. And it ended on time, so I'd have to say that it was a success. All the business that needed to be done got done.
This conference was unique because it is the very first time the NCRC came to a station that was broadcasting temporarily and had not been granted a permanent FM license.
There was a number of firsts at the conference this year. This was the first year the conference was held in a rural setting. This was the first year the conference was held by a station that wasn't yet a station. We have yet to get our broadcast license. We're merely applying for one. And this is the first year that we had a remote presenter in order to lower the carbon footprint of the overall conference. And the big first is this: the first conference that was broadcast from. And we applied for a temporary special event permit, 98.7, which we happen to know is available and open in the area.
Not only were the hosts of Gabriola Island Co-op Radio very gracious, but the whole island community of 4,000 were more than welcoming to all the guests from the NCRC. Right now we're standing here outside the patio of the Surf Lodge here on beautiful Gabriola Island. We are fortunate to have the courtesy of and this pleasure of speaking to one of the staff members here at the Surf Lodge.
Sarah Knight.
Do you remember when you first heard about the conference happening, coming into town?
Yeah, I heard about it probably around the winter time, sometime during the winter. And yeah, and we were told it was going to be really busy and nobody could take time off that week. Well, it was interesting. There's people in suits and then people in like studded belts. So it was a whole range of people. I didn't really have any expectations, but yeah, we knew it was going to be busy and it's been a great crowd, though. Really easygoing. Party atmosphere, like on jam night, was really busy. And
the island, the artists per capita ratio is very high here. So there are a lot of performances you often see. There's jams happening all the time.
We're proud of our artists and our musicians, like Brad on jam night. We're so lucky and take advantage of how much he plays and, you know, host that jam every Wednesday night, and it's nice to get more people out and experiencing it. So,
what's the general vibe been around town about having been on FM for this week?
Excited. You know, everybody was trying to tune in, and it's all on Facebook, and yeah, and I think everybody's been really supportive and good to be on the mat. I think everybody wants to be on the radio. I don't know. That's how I feel, but.
It was a comfortable and amiable week altogether. I got to meet a lot of people around the campfire, out at the beach, and around town. After the conference, community radio friends boarded the ferry for home. See you next year in Halifax. For Gramwell, this is Nick Panu.
All for this edition of Groundwire. I've been your host, Susie Alvarez.
And I'm Max Scott. Join us for a post-G20 deconstruction on July 3rd.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This edition produced at CKLN Community Radio in association with the G20 Alternative Media Center in Toronto.
Headlines by Annabelle Koo, Courtney Kirkby, Frida Worden, David Parker, and Jackie Tunistra Harrison. Production by Susie Alvarez.
Further support, Groundwire thanks the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Go to cupe.ca for more info and the Public Service Alliance of Canada. Think public and visit psac.com.
And that's our program for June 21st, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program. I'm Bronwyn Loden. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening to CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.